Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today I have a very special person. Her name is Elizabeth Percival. Elizabeth is a healer, a mother, a nana, that's what her grandchildren call her, an actress, a writer, an editor, and an entrepreneur. And today's conversation is going to go to a lot of very interesting places because Elizabeth has had a very interesting life. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, it's so great to be here.
It's great to have you.
Thank you for inviting me into this wonderful world you've created. I just have loved watching you unfold this over the years and express who you are so beautifully, especially because it includes supporting other people. Thank you for doing that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And Elizabeth, why don't you just talk, say what you're, so my commitment for the world, that's what we call it, is that all people are free to create lives they love, and also that we all elevate the conversation and consciousness of the planet together, which ties into yours, but I know you could say it much better than I could. What did you tell me before?
So my commitment for the world is that we all experience that we are one with everything and everyone through love. And I was going to tell you that story about how I found out about that I'm descended from Rabbi Luria.
Yeah.
Italy, who was one of the first Kabbalists. And through a serendipitous phone call, you know, look, I had this little piece of paper. Who is this? I don't know who this is. I think I'll call and find out. I was speaking to a man. I think he was a sound healer or something. I don't know how the question came up, but I told him I was descended from Rabbi Luria, and he said, you know, his teaching is love. And that is who I am. That's what I'm here for, is to be that. That's it. Like, all the other stuff is details.
That's
a great question, Hillary. I think it just has happened over time and noticing and letting go of all the things I have thought I was supposed to be and noticing who I am. Like, I kept noticing that that's what I come back to. That's what just comes out naturally when I'm expressing. That's when I'm most happy, is when I know that's who I'm being.
And so you're being love, or you're expressing, like, what does that look like on the court?
Well, it really doesn't matter what I'm doing. It matters who I'm being while I'm doing it. And what that is accepting and loving myself, accepting and loving others, and really being willing to let go. You know how they say, don't sweat the small stuff and it's all small stuff? Mm-hmm. It has begun to feel like that for me. The older I get too, you know how they say the older you get, the less you care about what other people think of you? And I that's happening. I'm like, well, here I am, you know.
So what did you have to give up to be?
Oh, being right. Definitely being right about how people should be acting, how I have to keep forgiving myself, you know, because I'm one of those people who tends to blame myself for everything that's gone wrong. And it's just how I am. You know, that's just a tendency that I have. So I get to forgive myself all the time. And I get to, when I'm just noticing that I'm saying I get to, not like I have to. Mm-hmm. And that's part of it. I get to, it's a privilege for me to be with other people exactly as they are. Mm. You know, I just moved to Alaska a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I lived in the mountains of North Carolina for 43 years. And I had a great posse of women there. Mm. And here I didn't know very many people except my son and my daughter and his in-law family a little bit, who have become very dear to me. But I noticed myself not saying very much when I was in groups of people. So part of it is just letting things be what they are instead of, I used to have to put my two cents in. Mm-hmm. I had to put my two cents in. And I used to say, I cannot find a better way to say this. I don't like this phrase, but I have called myself, my family, the be right or die family. And so I always had to make sure that you knew what I thought about it. Mm-hmm. I don't have to do that. And sometimes.
But so what had you give that up? Like, what was the moment when you said, oh, I don't really have to do that?
Well, I'd say that all of this stuff has happened gradually. It's like, it's practice and then noticing it works. Mm. So it builds on it. It's like, okay, I'm, you know, part of it is really is having done Landmark for so many years. Mm-hmm. The practices that I, you know, there's this practice, which is letting go. Like how do you let go a tissue? You let go of it. You don't think about it. You don't wish you're going to do it. You don't hope, maybe someday I'll let go. Oh, you let go. Like what is that? You know, you're afraid before it happens and then you do it and then you do it again and it's easier and you do it again and it's easier like that. Mm. Like letting go, letting you be who you are. I have a friend who is down that hole that people have gone down, and I love this person, and I completely disagree with her about just about everything now, even though we used to agree about a lot. And I don't have to tell her that I'm right about things. Oh. I really want to. I really want to. And I want her to come over here. I want her to come over here. Come over here and think what I'm thinking. It would be better. But it doesn't do any, it doesn't further life.
Mm-hmm. To be right. Yeah.
It just doesn't. And life is so delicious. I'm very happy to be a human being.
Good. But can I just say one thing about the blame thing? Because I used to blame myself for everything. And I used to say, like, if people were complaining about the weather or the traffic, I was like, you know what? I didn't do that. That's not that. I didn't cause those. So I was very happy about that. But everything else, it was like, oh, no, did I get that person upset? You know, anyway, I've come a long way myself. But I just thought that was funny. Weather and traffic. Mm-mm, didn't do it.
So you had a couple of things you didn't have to attach yourself to.
Exactly.
Look at you.
I was like, not my fault. Everything else I thought was mine too. So anyway, that was funny. Okay. So let's see. So yesterday we were talking about how you were born in Long Island as Jane.
I was born on Long Island.
Yeah.
In Nassau County Hospital.
Wow.
In Mineola, 1945. I was born right at the end of World War II. And then 6 weeks later, my father was drafted into the Army. He had tried to get into the Army at the beginning of the war, but they wouldn't take him. He had something on his lung or something. And so this is my cat. Yeah. That's Charlie. Hey, Charlie. And so he left Long Island and went to the mountains of Virginia where his family was from. And the family kind of gathered cousins and my grandmother, my granny, and another aunt all got together in this big house during the for the war duration of the war. And then we moved back to Long Island when I was about 3 years old.
So he came back then?
Yeah, came back. Couldn't find a house down there and moved back to Long Island and lived out really on the island in North Babylon until I was 15. When I was 15, we moved into the city. And I think I was telling you my first name is Jane. My name is Jane Elizabeth Percival. My mother loved Jane Austen, so I was named Jane. And out on Long Island, I was the only Jane in the school, 1,500 people. Jane was me. Martin Van Buren High School in Queens, where I moved, it looked like everybody was named Jane. Every time I turned around to respond to someone who called my name, it wasn't me they were talking about. And there were 1,500 people in my class instead of 1,500 people in my school. So that was but I'm really glad I did it.
So was that when you switched to Elizabeth?
No, I switched to Elizabeth way later.
Oh, okay.
That's maybe three stories later.
Okay. All right. So you're in Queens, you go to high school, and then where'd you go to college?
I went to Hofstra. Okay. I had a drama scholarship. And then I was in this, I didn't tell you this yesterday, I was in this wonderful program, which was one of the first interdisciplinary programs in a college. It was called New College at Hofstra. And we worked in units instead of terms. And I got 45 credits in my first year doing that. It was a wonderful, wonderful program. The different professors would, like, your science professor would mark your essay for the week. You had to do an essay every week. He would mark your essay that was about literature. So all the professors were willing to do, we had, I forget what you call it. We'd get together every week and have discussion groups on stuff that we'd read. You could have your art professor doing your discussions on your science readings. It was really wonderful experience. And I got 45 credits. So as a drama major with a scholarship, I had to be in every play or on a crew for every single play for 4 years.
Wow.
So that gave me the space to do less classes for the rest of college, which really worked out well for me.
Wow. Okay. And then you said...
Then I was in love with this guy. He was at Columbia, and he went back to San Francisco. He was from San Francisco, and I was in love with him. So I got on a bus. It cost me $45 to get on this 1949 school bus. I saw the ad in the Village Voice and got in this school bus and landed in San Francisco on August 18th, 1966.
Wow.
Guess what I landed in the middle of? I had no idea what hippiedom was.
Oh.
I mean, I had friends.
Did you find the guy? That's what I want to know.
I did find the guy. I had a hippie marriage. We got married.
Okay.
Got married on acid in
to him.
Nevada.
To him? Oh, okay.
Yeah. And what did I say? I used to say I had his name, his insurance, and his mother's pearls. So we were married. And
did you stay married to him?
I did not. I left him when I was in the theater. I went into the American Conservatory Theater School. I got a scholarship to be in their conservatory program. And then I was in their company for a year. And before I decided I didn't want to be an actress, I actually met a spiritual teacher and went on that journey in my 20s. But it was...
Was that like a master's or something? Or it was just a program? After college?
The American Conservatory Theater?
Yeah.
That was it was called a training program.
Okay.
It's still going on today.
For actors and actresses?
Yes.
The theater.
Many, many, many famous people have been in that. Harry Hamlin was in that.
Wow.
Michael Learned, who was the mother in the Waltons. Will Geer, who was the grandfather in the Waltons. They were all in the theater with us. It was an extraordinary experience. And it was direct preparation for me then going into this spiritual life that I took on. One of the
so how did you go? You're in this training program. How did you switch to, like, how did you find the spiritual leader?
Okay, so that was a woman who I met, who was one of the, okay, when I landed in San Francisco, actually, I called my boyfriend, didn't even know I was coming. Okay. I just went. Called him up. He said, you know, you can't stay here. I'm living with my parents. I was like, huh? So I happened to have met a friend of a friend, and I ended up in this house on 11th Avenue in San Francisco. We called it the 11th Avenue Circus. It turned into this total hippie house. There were girls upstairs and boys downstairs, and then people started taking those substances, and the lines became blurred. And it was the hippie experience, you know.
Did your lines become blurred too?
My lines became blurred. I took drugs, and it was it was an extraordinary experience. It was the beginning of it, and we did it. I like to say this. We took the drug that we took LSD just a few times for me. I mean, some people did it a lot, but we were very careful about it because we knew that it was doing something, that it was expanding our consciousness. Mm. And we did it consciously. We took 2 days to do it. We would do it. And then we would spend a day kind of resting before we went back into life. We looked at what we had learned. It was part of my, what I call unfoldment.
Yeah.
And so I met a woman who lived in this house where I lived, the circus. Mm-hmm. And she had been Gurudeva's student, and she told me about him. And then when I left Ted, my first husband, I moved in with this guy who I met in the theater. And in the front hall of that house, this course called the Master Course, that wasn't for me, for somebody else, kept arriving and sitting on the front. You know, some person who had lived in this house before had ordered this Master Course, and which was the teaching of this teacher.
Oh.
There it was, sitting in this house. So it was kind of in my mind. And then somebody invited me to go to him speaking.
And what was his name again?
In those days, his name was Master Subramunya, and eventually the whole thing became really Hindu, Saivite Hinduism, and he took on the name Sivaya Subramunya Swami. Oh,
okay.
And we called him Gurudeva. And he was an American. He was a very tall, blonde American who had been one of the premier dancers of the San Francisco Ballet and went to the East to study Native dancing and met a teacher there when he became enlightened and came back, and people started going to him. And there's a temple in Kauai to this day, a beautiful temple there. So I just feel like I had the privilege of that time when I really got to. So one of the first things I heard Gurudeva say before he was ever my student, the first time I heard him speak, he said, and he's standing there in a gray suit, holding a recorder. This is in the 60s, you know. So they were already very into the technology, the group was. They always used Apple computers for their publications and everything. So here's Gurudeva standing there in this round building at San Francisco State, and he says, "We have learned to go in and in and in a very specific way. And when we get in, we experience that nothing matters. And then we have learned to come out and out and out in a very specific way. And we've learned that we must act out here as if everything matters."
Hmm.
And I've never forgotten that, because there's this nothingness. That's what Saivism says, that there's, like, God is basically the nothing that enlivens everything. And you experience that, but what do we say? God Siva is immanent love and transcendent reality. So the love is I've never said this before, Hillary. The love is everything matters. The transcendent reality is the experience that nothing matters.
Wow.
So that's,
So the immanent love is, wait, say that again. That that
the
nothing
immediate
matters.
Love is the is you
oh is that everything matters
is when you're experiencing that everything yeah. matters, when you act as if everything matters, even though you can with when you meditate deeply, or even just in choosing it, experiencing that this is, you know, not, it's not, there isn't meaning to everything. But in order to function in the world, you gotta act like it does. And really, that's, I think, that what we've experienced in Landmark. I call Landmark the wisdom of the ages distilled into a workable technology.
And she's referring to Landmark Worldwide. If you don't know about it, you can go to landmarkworldwide.com and find out. That's where we went.
Yeah. And it's what I would say it's, I don't know if it's my practice. My practice has come from the work that I do there. It's my community. And
I would say it's a transformational technology, a community of people who are committed to a world that works for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Really. And discovering what's possible for human being. And so going back to when I was in the theater, one of the exercises we did when I was in the conservatory was called getting to zero. Because in order to take on a character, you have to let go of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So we would do an exercise called getting to zero and then consciously take on a voice, a movement, a thought of a person who you were personifying as an actor. That was the beginning, what I would say, of my having the, you know, this spiritual experience. So the theater was a direct preparation for me of what became yogic meditation and yoga. All right.
So tell me, I know you'd said when you're in the conservatory, you got $60 a week, right? You're out in California.
So the first year I had a scholarship, I was training. The second year I was asked to be in the company, and we were in a special company, and it was called the Forum Company.
Oh,
that was the name of it. And we supported ourselves by doing shows for schools and, you know, for fancy parties for people, like shortened versions of plays. And we did a whole thing called The Nature of Comedy, where we showed people how you make people laugh is one, you do it three times, on the third time people laugh. There's a whole structure to making people laugh. So like that.
So you supported yourself that way. And then when you went to do your spiritual journey or whatever you call it, you know, you went from the structured, I don't know what it looks like, but how did you support yourself? I'm always the
practical. Oh, good question.
I'm like practical.
First thing I did, downtown San Francisco, next to the Geary Theater, there's two Jewish delicatessens. I forget what the name of one of them is. The other one is David's. And that was the very fancy one, very European glass case with all of the, you know, rum balls and cake and, you know, challah. It was, they had their own bakery. And I went in there and said I wanted to be a waitress. And he asked me if I'd ever been one. I said no. He said, well, too bad. So I went home for Christmas. When I came back, I lied to him and told him that I'd been a waitress in Connecticut while I was home for Christmas. And one night, and he put me on the late shift, you know, when people coming out of the theater. And one day he came to me and he said, I know you lied to me, but you're doing pretty well.
All right. So that's how you supported yourself. Okay, good. So then what did you do by day? What does it look like to be on a spiritual journey, or do you want to move on? I don't know where.
No, that's fine. Actually, I did these different jobs. I was also a substitute teacher in Connecticut. I worked as the executive, the person in the front of the office, receptionist at Morgan Stanley in New York.
Wow.
On the executive floor. That was awesome. I got to the world came through my desk, you know, like finance ministers of Australia. And I got to see the first Polaroid camera where you took the picture and the thing slid out and you saw the picture create itself. I saw the prototype for that. you know, like that. That
so
was
you didn't really- stay in San Francisco, obviously.
No, I went back to my family's home in Connecticut. My mother was the director, the alumni director at Barnard. So she had an apartment in the city. So we'd be in the city during the week. And then we'd go up to Kent, Connecticut, where my dad was refurbishing this house that they bought. And I was a substitute teacher there in Connecticut part of the time.
So how did you get...
I would go on these inner searches. That was the intensives that we would take. I traveled to Switzerland. I went around the world, went mainly to India, but Russia and Thailand and Japan.
So wait, hold on. You're in the... I like to get the chronology here. You're in the theater. You're doing all this stuff. You have David's Deli. Okay. You meet the spiritual guy.
Right. We'll call him Gurudeva.
Okay. And then how'd you get to Connecticut? Like, how long were you doing him?
This is interesting, actually, because I was, the first inner search I went on was to Switzerland, to Ascona, Switzerland. We were at Casa Uranos that had Carl Jung's unpublished writings. This was the part of Switzerland where Hermann Hesse and Jung and that group of people lived.
Yeah.
So they were known there. And so we had this wonderful retreat there. And when Gurudeva said, unmarried women should live with their families. So I went home to Connecticut from San Francisco.
Okay.
So I ended up in Connecticut.
Okay. Okay. All right.
And then I would get money together and do another inner search, or borrow the money from someone and do the inner search and pay it back. You know, that my life was going on these extraordinary trips that were really amazing. I got to sit with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala. I got to stand in front of enlightened beings. It was really an extraordinary time in my life. And it gave me this very rich inner life. But one of the things that I, looking back, noticed I became was what I call a spiritual snob. And so at some point I left the group. And somebody, you know, I don't know, got a message from Gurudeva or anything and asked about me and said, and he said that we had gone as far as we could go in this life and that I just had other things to do. And I knew I wanted to get married and have kids. And I also lived in Hawaii for a while with other women who were celibate.
Hmm.
And that was when I really could tell that I wanted to get married. I didn't want to be a nun, so to speak.
Right.
And so one day Gurudeva said to us, asked me, he said, do you want to get married? I said, yeah. He said, great, go get married. Call me when you have your first child. So that's what I did. I left. And since then, I haven't been officially part of that group, but it's still in my heart. It is the center of my belief. And how I, you know, it just gave me so much early in my life. You can hear me talking about it. It was the seminal experience of my early life, my early adult life.
So how did you just like go get married? Where did you find the guy?
Oh boy, that's a story. Okay. So
we have 3 minutes until the commercial break. So.
Okay. So I met him on the phone. He called me up from my sister's house in North Carolina. Somebody had borrowed his coat and there was a picture. He had bought Gurudeva's books. We were selling Gurudeva's books. Somebody had gone down to Boone, North Carolina and put these books in the local bookstore. And my to-be husband had one of these books and had pictures of me from these trips that we had been on. I was in the book,
like as part of the book.
Yeah, Gurudeva's writings with pictures. And so his friend had borrowed his coat and had this book in the pocket, was at my sister's house. And she said, hey, my sister's picture's in that book. And that's how Terry Grayson found out that I was also studying with Gurudeva. And he called me from my sister's house. We talked to each other for, this is 1979, $250 worth of phone calls. And we decided to get married before we met each other. We met on the platform at Union Station, and I was in Boston at the time, met on the platform at Union Station, and We had a red rose apiece, but we both looked really like hippies, and everybody else was like had a suitcase and a suit. It was 9 o'clock on a weekday morning, so we didn't need the red roses. We met on the platform, and that was it. We got married three months later, had two children, then got divorced.
Mm. Yeah. How long were you married?
17 years.
Mm. That's pretty long. And did you contact Gerd Davis after and say, I had my first kid?
Yep. Had Ganesha, was my first child. Ganesha is the god of wisdom and success in Hinduism. Oh. And I called him up and he said, great, move to New York. There's a Hindu temple there in Flushing. And it turned out to be exactly where my family had lived. I was going to the same laundromat that I went to as a teenager when I was there.
And you moved back to New York because he said to.
For 2 years we lived there, and then we came back to the mountains and lived in the mountains.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been awesome. It's been a wonderful, wonderful life.
So what did you guys do? I know we have to go to commercial, but I just have, I'm always thinking, how did you survive? What kind of work did you do that you could just move around like that?
Well, my now ex-husband had a house. This was great because I hadn't, you know, I moved all the time. I didn't own anything. Right. When I started wanting to get married, I was buying stuff like crystal glasses in secondhand stores, you know. Right. That's what I was thinking of. That's what called me. Yeah. But he had, you know, a tofu maker and a blender and a house and a car and a truck and a farm. He had everything. I didn't need to.
So that's what he did? He ran the farm?
Yes, and he also worked, he became a VCR repairman. And what else did he do? And he still, I call him the dirt guy. He knows more about soil than anybody I've ever met. Hmm. And he's made fertilizer. He still has, he's made a heritage orchard now, apple orchard. But by the way, he happened to be a paranoid schizophrenic alcoholic, which is why I got divorced. That's another whole story. So maybe you should go on a commercial break and we'll come back.
Well, I just want to know one last question.
Yeah.
Did he move to New York with you for 2 years?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he did. Okay.
But then he wanted to leave and go back to the mountains. That's what he said to me one day. I'm going back to the mountains. Are you coming?
And you did.
Okay. Yes. I did.
Well, that's a good combo. Paranoid, schizophrenic, alcoholic. Nice. Very nice. Okay. Yeah. On that note, we're going to go to the commercial break and we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to RealTalkWithHillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Okay, thank you as always to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you want to bring experiential social emotional learning to your schools, to your businesses, to your teams, go to Kikori. You find them at KikoriApp.com. It is a platform, experiential social emotional learning platform. My daughter has corrected me on the terminology, and they're amazing. So check it out. And it really does bring connection, like we're talking about, love, socialization to the children, especially after COVID. You know, sometimes they kind of lose it. They're on their technology, and this brings them connected to each other. So I highly recommend it. And then, as always, my books. We have my memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast. If you need a good read, or you feel like you're stuck, I was. This is my story of how I got unstuck. It's very inspiring, very courageous to write, because it's very real and you're not allowed to judge me. Okay? So that's The Second Piece of French Toast. We also have this. If you're someone who's afraid to speak up like I was, it's called Real Talk. You can get it at realtalkwithhillary.com. And there's a process. It's called the Getting Real Process, which has you find an area of your life that's not working. You use this program. You can also get in touch with me, and really things start to open up in a magical way. It certainly works for me. And then my third book, Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. This is about the two sides of life. There's one on the left side where nothing seemed very good and I was kind of stuck. And then I saw there was a right side of life where everything was a lot more fun. There was possibility, there was hope. And so I decided to look for techniques that could have me spend less time on the left and more on the right. The subtitle is How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. They really work for me. I'm still looking for techniques. I love it. I'm kind of a nerd for that. And then also something I always forget to mention is my newsletter. And you could find that. The link is on my YouTube channel, YouTube, Getting Real with Hillary with one L. You can also find it at my website, which is sort of under construction, but it's still there, gettingrealwithhillary.com. It's a weekly newsletter filled with stories, links to my stuff, to my TikToks, all the good stuff, and you don't have to search because it's all right there. So now I'd like to bring back Elizabeth Percival, and I'm excited to see where we're going to go next in the conversation. And if you see if you see a tail wagging back and forth, that's her cat. She does not have a tail. Yeah, that's her.
I feel that Charlie is part Siamese, and that's why she talks.
Okay.
She doesn't look like a Siamese. She looks like a tabby, but she's a talker. She's a...
All right, good. All right. So where were we? So we had gotten you married. We want to get to your brain gem. So we want to end up there. Where?
That would be good. That's good. Okay, this is how that happened. One of the things that I did after I was in the theater, I decided that so I was in the theater. Then I was with Gurudeva. And then I went back to Connecticut. And I got interested in the Montessori method. Hmm. So I studied Montessori, and I worked at a Montessori school in Boone, North Carolina. And one afternoon, a woman came to do a program with the teachers after school. And she did this stuff called Brain Gym, which I say are movements that help your brain and your body work better together. And she did the core activity, which is called a repatterning. Mm-hmm. And it is very simple movements, but it really shifts how your left and right brains work together. This is actually one of the symbols of Brain Gym, is your hands together like that. It's kind of like your brains, your two brains working together. And I did this, you know, we just did this walking around in a circle. She gave us the activities to do, and there was a goal that you stated. And that night, I mean, my experience of my body had completely shifted. And I happened to go out. I recommend to people when we do this work that you don't go out after your first session, that you stay home and integrate. I almost fell down the stairs, and it's like three steps in a high school lobby. We were going to a play, but I mean, You know, we talk about perturbation, how things move when you start, when you're going through some kind of transformation, your homeostasis, the way you're used to being, gets shaken up in some way before it resettles in a new way. That's basically what happens in transformation. That's what I experienced in my body, was that my molecules weren't where they were in the afternoon. It was a new thing going on. And so I went to this woman and I said, I would really like to study this. And I didn't have money. And so one of the things that my ex-husband had done was planted some trees. That's something that the hippies that lived in the mountains of North Carolina did in the winter, was go down south and plant pine trees in fields. Hmm. I didn't do it. You know, whole families went there. They went in trucks and buses. And I was like, I had this wonderful 12-room house that I lived in with my husband. I was like, I'll be here when you get home, honey. The kids will be here. But so he had done that. And so he had a bunch of extra trees that he planted in our garden and in the orchard. So I planted 5 pine trees, white pine trees, and I created a strawberry garden for her. That's how I paid for my first brain gym class. And when I teach it, I say, when I go back to her home, which is called the Metamorphosis Center. Actually, she just recently passed away. Her name was Sue Green. She taught so many people this program. People from all over the world came there to teach. We were very fortunate to have her there, right in Boone, North Carolina. And
did you plant the trees and the strawberries in her yard?
In her yard.
Oh, okay.
That's how I paid. For my course. And when I go to her place, I see these trees that are now huge, huge, huge trees. And it puts me in mind of what Gurudeva used to say about how he was training monks. He said, I'm cultivating trees for the future. Mm. You know, I'm planting trees. And so that just makes me think about Brain Gym and all the years that I've worked in it since 1996, and just thousands of people who've been affected by it. I know a woman who's taught Brain Gym in schools. She's affected, 25,000 people with the work that she's done.
And what is the impact? Like, how would you say people are changed by it?
It integrates your neurological system. It actually creates new neurological connections in your brain and your body. Because our bodies, the neural net of our brain is created by the movements that babies make in utero and right after they're born. And some of these movements actually reflect back to those movements that children make early on. And as children grow through that process, there can be holes in the development. And when you're under stress, now that's one way you can get a hole in your developmental pattern, or you can get a stress from an accident. You can get a stress from being married to a paranoid schizophrenic alcoholic. You know, there's lots of different ways that you can, we call it trauma, but it can happen in all different ways, early on in your life or later. But what happens is when you're under stress, you go back to where the early hole is. Mm. And that's what you function from. So when you do this work and you reestablish these neurological connections, you close up these holes, you get fuller sensory access. Because what we're always doing is taking in information, integrating information, and expressing it. And you want to have full sensory access in order to do that. So that's basically what it does. But what I love about it is that it works not just for being able to read better or see better or move better. Somebody created a whole program called Switched on Golf, doing Brain Gym to improve people's golf games. Wow. Excuse me. People use it for business. I like to use it for human development, for transformation. That's my love.
Yeah. All right, so we were gonna do a little bit so people could do it where they're at watching. Are you ready for that?
Very, very interestingly, I just did the first thing. So there's four pieces of this. It's called PACE, getting in PACE for learning, because we're always learning. Learning isn't just school. We're always taking in information. So, and wanting to integrate it and wanting to express it. So we're going to do four things in this PACE, getting in PACE for learning. The first thing is drinking water. And you just drink as much as you want to. Notice when you have had enough. It could be a sip. It could be lots of gulp.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Do you see what I did there?
Yeah.
It's a great way to drink water. Smoosh it around in your mouth okay. before you swallow, because it actually goes into your system through your mouth. You get more of it that way. That's just a little hint. So that's number one. Number two is called brain buttons.
Okay.
And you make a C with one hand, and you go below your collarbone, just below your collarbone, on either side of your sternum, and you find there could be indentations. Everybody's body's different, and it might hurt a little bit. Move around a little bit and see if you find a place where it's a little tender. It often is right there. And then your other hand goes on your middle, on your belly.
Okay.
Some people call it where your chi is, or it might just be your belly button, wherever you want to put your other hand, where you would call your center. Okay, so you're going to do that. And you can also track with your eyes from one side to the other and blink a little bit while you're doing that. Don't stare. You're actually integrating your vertical and your horizontal here. Hmm. And now you can take your top hand and put that on your belly. Take your bottom hand, make that C, and massage again those two points. For people who know about meridians, the Chinese meridians, this is K27. It's the top of the kidney meridian. The brain gym, you learn a lot more than just, well, when you do brain gym, you learn 26 movements. But then you get into there's a whole other range of stuff you can do, including touch for health. This information about the meridians comes from touch for health and Chinese medicine. Okay, so you just do that until you feel like you're done. That's one of the things you learn in brain gym is noticing. Mm-hmm. Notice when it's enough for your body. If you find yourself like doing it, then you're finished.
Okay.
The next thing you're going to do is called cross crawls. And you can do this standing or sitting. You're going to lift one knee and you're going to touch. So I'm going to lift my left knee and I'm going to touch my right elbow or your hand to the opposite knee. Lift one knee, touch it with the opposite hand or elbow. Oh. You can do that about 30 times on each side. This is integrating your left and right brains. You're crossing your midline. And that gets your two brains to work together. Excuse me, I'm going to cough. I have a cold. Hey, I've done pretty well, haven't I?
Yeah.
I thought I'd be coughing way more than that. Yeah, so just enjoy that. And you can do this lots of ways. You can stand up and do it. You can lift your foot behind you and touch it with the opposite hand. Kids get into it in a real dancing way. They love it.
All right. I've done my 30.
There you go. And so that's a good thing. When you first start, especially if you're what we call kind of a left brain person who wants to know, how many do? 30. And then start noticing, oh, I want to do more. Oh, I don't really need to do 30. 10 is enough, you know. You'd be noticing. Okay, so that's number three. We did water for one, brain buttons for two, cross crawl for three. Now we're on four. And we're going to cross your ankles. Just cross your legs right at your ankles. And look down and notice which leg is on top. My right leg is on top. So when I do this, now here's the next part. Put your hands back to back. And because I have my right ankle on top, I'm going to put my right hand on top.
Oh.
And then I'm going to swing down. Okay.
I had the wrong one on top. And my left goes on top.
Yes.
I'll switch my left. Now,
because when you're finished, you want your wrist, so my left wrist is on top, my right ankle is on top.
Oh, all right. Then I was right. Okay. My right. Okay. Got it.
Well, this is called Tibetan eights, actually. This comes from, you're making an eight with your body. If you just kind of look, you'll see that you're kind of, there's an eight pattern happening in your body because of this. Two eights, actually.
Okay.
And that's another whole study. There's so many places you can go with brain gymnastics. One of the things I love about it, it opens a whole world of brain-body transformational work that I've enjoyed over the years and like to share. So now you want to relax. I'm going to lean back a little bit. You can put your tongue on the roof of your mouth if you want to. You can even touch the bottom of your chin with your thumb. That's another thing that you can choose if you want to. That's the top of your central meridian in Chinese medicine. And you'll notice yourself kind of calming down. This is my favorite activity in brain gym. Mm-hmm. If I could teach one thing, this would be it.
See, I just want to go to sleep.
Isn't it? You get into your body. So if you're tired, you'll feel that.
Mm.
And you may, sometimes you'll notice you're taking a breath. And again, now I'm just noticing my shoulders have been kind of tight while I've been talking, and they're starting to relax a little bit. So just do this until you're ready to go on to the next part. This movement called hookups has two parts. This is the first part.
Do we let go when we're ready?
Yeah, just let go and put both feet on the floor, uncross your ankles, put your feet flat on the floor, and then you're going to take your hands and you're going to hold the world in your hands like that. And you can hold it up or you can hold it down wherever you want, but just have your fingertips touching. So this is the second part of hookups. And again, you can have your tongue on the roof of your mouth behind your teeth if you want to. That when you put your tongue there like that, you're accessing your midbrain, which is the emotional center of your brain. So if you can't do anything else, if you're in a situation where you don't want to like make yourself look like a pretzel, just stick your tongue on the roof of your mouth behind your teeth, and you'll have somewhat this calming effect. You'll be accessing your midbrain.
Wow.
Relaxing it.
All right. So I'm watching the time and we have like 2.5 minutes left. And I want,
well, that was,
yeah, that was, and I want you to be able to tell people how they find you if they want to know more about the brain gym, when your classes are, and we can also put them in the show notes. So they can.
Okay. That'll be great. So I'll just say it verbally and then they'll be in the show notes.
Okay.
And thank you so much, Hillary, for this. This has been a wonderful conversation. And I'm
very relaxed. I hope you all do at home. I hope you feel as relaxed and just mellow.
It's so nice. And yet present.
Yeah.
Ready.
Yeah, present.
Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so
go ahead.
I created first of all, how do you get in touch with me? Elizabeth@wearedreamscometrue.online. O-N-L-I-N-E. I lost my .com.
All right, Elizabeth, in the final 30 seconds, what is your vision for the world?
My vision for the world. I'm just going to say it again.
Okay.
We experience that we are one with everything and everyone through love.
And if that was the case, what would be possible? What would that feel like or look like?
The first thing that comes to my mind is it would be really easy to forgive all day long. Yourself and other people. Just forgive, 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 and then enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. And play. Playing together would be possible. Honoring each other's journeys. Everybody has their own thing that is their expression of who they are. And people would be doing that, and we'd just be having a heck of a time.
Wow, that's beautiful. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you. This was fascinating and fun, and I feel so mellow. I hope you all do at home. And anything in closing, Elizabeth?
Love you. Go forth and love.
Yes. All right. Thank you. Bye, everyone. Thanks, we'll see you next week. Yeah. It was really fun.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started Getting Real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony, and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.